Okay, so when you're ready to start, you'll just begin talking?
Yeah, yes. I'll have them introduced that the meeting is online.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
If you need anything, just call out to me.
Certainly will. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I couldn't reach. Could you do me a favor and plug in my extension cord?
No, actually,
thank you.
Yeah.
Most blackbirds take their charges, but mine don't.
Good morning.
What's that? Huh?
What do you think
about? I didn't give you this one back. This is the one I found out. This is the one he had.
That's why I got for me. I'm trying to help.
I'm
kind
of like, I take care of that. I don't want to.
You know what?
Because it's the one that actually works.
He said,
kind of buried under there. It's not a good crawl.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Good job. Didn't you
have
that? Oh, boy. Yeah, I mean, like, some place you like.
That's not my job.
I ain't no
job.
Yeah, I mean, I have one of my. No, I didn't. My breast.
Oh. Who said no? My birthday. My birthday. Insert call.
Good. Where was it? Which one?
It was Cook Fiction Canada.
I didn't make a reservation.
So I can come up with the coffee. I did not pass.
Have that little trip thing where they
is it? Insert card.
No, it's like, fine, I'll go sit there.
Right, that's great.
I was really impressed, too. And I was thinking this morning,
Okay, you know, next.
David, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, it was a little warm even this morning.
I don't know, but flavor.
I'm
going to go do that.
It is,
that.
But I'm saying it's probably...
So, John, the question for you. Why would thumb drive yesterday all the
time
stop working?
It would,
But I tried here, shutting down the computer, unplugging the computer. Couldn't get my thumb drive to work or Nicole's thumb drive to work. Okay, it's in my machine. But when I got back to the room, I'm going to find out in a minute. Now, what I did tonight is I downloaded everything on the thumb drive, the hard drive. So I'm not thumb drive sending today.
Is there any new updated material between the computer and the thumb drive available?
And we have
They can figure out. Beats me. I was ready to call Dell last night, and computers will drive you crazy every day. Mine's working. When I got back to the room, I worked perfectly. I was going to call Dell and see if there was anything online.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly.
Oh, good.
Don't ask me what happened
to it. I
know.
They act up at the wrong time.
But what I did was I downloaded the entire thumb drive to the hard drive.
Okay.
So that I wasn't thumb drive dependent today or on the plane.
Right. Good.
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Caribou.
It was a
what is it?
Oh, good for you.
Number, what about 1 million the size of
Starbucks?
Starbucks, but it's huge size.
Next door. I mean, as far as
you do.
Not much. I walked down. Outside.
Asshole.
Came back and kind of called.
How are you today?
Good.
No, I can't hear you.
Okay.
Oh, you came in like yesterday?
I mean, before.
Morning. Rochester's.
Yes, I think
actual travel time.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just kind of curious.
5 minutes.
That shit?
Yeah, a little bit in the air.
Getting out of it.
That's
you don't need it anymore.
We left it.
Right. Okay.
I don't. You and I have exactly the same.
Okay.
You gotta be careful.
I decorate one.
Oh, okay. Good. Good.
Yeah. I think we have a rule we're not supposed to put anything on.
So. Oh, do you?
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
I think
we have at least one.
Yeah, there's
lots of slides. Whatever you're doing,
what I'm gonna do.
Yeah, late,
I guess, and
the baby's
going.
Okay.
Too much. I took a walk.
You can check your bags. And they have the ball. I'll just okay. Yeah.
Climbing out of the chair.
Yeah.
No.
And I took my
boys back. Yeah.
And I
figured. Hi. Good. Yeah. I mean, actually, it's a nice opportunity because the day is beautiful.
I have my day, and we're expecting Dr. Berger's
room. Okay. Actually, I'm
going to go across
the street. Nicole? I mean, Major is right across the street. Deadly. I'm just glad we're
going to be
here. Yeah, too many opportunities to run over.
I sent the two of them were the CAP survey,
okay.
And one was that care coordination article from.
Also, there was not material.
No.
Okay.
The only thing was a like a visual schematic as one of the measures we'll be reviewing.
Okay.
And I think that's it. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a simple like one page.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like that.
With the time change,
well, there's certain.
Again, one of those. As tenants, we pay for it, but it's useful.
I hiked all over. I did the whole loop.
Right, you have to move down. I feel like he would do that. And enjoy the and all numbers repeated is affected by my curious. Yeah, exactly. But do you know that it has WGR? Ellie will have you because I'm sure
the children of one of my best friends, a grown up, they're 20 year olds. I took them out to dinner and did it with them. One of them, the healthcare advisory board. She just got.
No.
Oh, good.
I was telling her my experience. One works for NASA. And it's unbelievable. She deals with natural disasters.
Yeah.
She's got a daughter, PhD, and Princeton is a woman. She's a brilliant. I've known her since the day she was born. You know, a brilliant girl. She was a valedictorian. She's a great kid. So, but you can tell that, you know, even though they have jobs, they're financial. They were thrilled to go out to a nice restaurant.
Where'd you go?
Oh yeah, by the hotel around 2 blocks away. Asian type of.
Oh place. Yeah, I think I saw that.
Quite good. Quite good. Not cheap, but good.
Yeah.
And it was one of those where I had to ask them to put me in a place where it was a little quieter.
Larder.
I don't get that.
I know.
But actually, I do. That keeps people moving. Like that creates turn. Restaurant.
All right.
That you make it so quiet and complete. You go safe.
Right. Yeah. So, he used to work for NASA. I know the daughter. Yeah. Did she have anything with him out of this?
No. She doesn't deal with those kinds of things.
Oh,
she deals with volcanoes and earthquakes and predicting. But yeah, no, we talked. So those are man-made. We don't share that.
Oh, it's just natural.
It's like the difference between being a surgeon and medicine.
Talk to them.
Yeah.
I'll help you. Out of sight, out of mind. You left for a second.
But it was
Oh, thank you so much. You're welcome. And I can just...
This is National Mental Health Awareness Day.
Oh, it is?
Yes. Sure. Canada Pediatrics is a sponsor.
Right? Yeah.
Why did you say that the body is?
I'm the token psychiatrist.
Sorry, bye.
Not the model of business. Great credentials. We have the need for it.
Yeah. Do something. So the rest of us progress.
No. I studied medicine. Wow, so you've done the Westwood.
It's going to be hard for you now that Charlie's moving in.
That's stuck.
I know.
She's in the center.
I guess you're right.
I am in California. Okay.
How do I do without it?
I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, there are any number of groups that...
Cool. Yeah. How long should I figure to get from here to Dulles? At around 3 o'clock.
I think it should take
you
say
an hour? An hour and a half. Give me enough leeway for traffic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We actually went through yesterday and that's all of them except for one.
Good morning.
I think that's just a lick.
I'm traveling, and I believe that my secure ID is out of sync because I can't password.
P090122.
We need to move another chair in. Yeah. I'm going to
go get it in the water.
Go do my dishes.
Can you move this chair down there?
Can
you move this chair?
Hermie?
Yes.
I went to Rizal. I had their own grand. I ate almost every day. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I
got reservations.
I got lucky. I just stumbled there, and then I stumbled there after walking around.
Is that what
doing
now? That was
okay.
Okay.
There's a chair up front.
Oh, yes, I did. I lose many of these cats. Sorry, you want me to do it?
Yeah, just a second.
Okay, it just changed. I'll put it there.
Okay.
It worked. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
I'm going to own you for the rest of my life.
Here, you want mine?
I don't need one. Here.
You got it? Yeah.
And on.
I can move this little chair.
I knew where your cast was, and I was running back home.
We have one of our
psychologists.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Invited. And it's 90% of women show up.
Sure.
So she just. You gotta come. You gotta go. I can't. They get you into this. They want you to get into this relaxed state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. You were relaxed.
Yeah. They said, no, that's not quite what we. I said, yeah. When I relax, I sleep. Why shouldn't? But I should. I sleep. It's probably the. You know, I can't touch my toes.
Oh, no.
Down here, and I'm happy.
She would be ready to go.
Okay.
That's the coffee they have there. Mm-hmm.
I got all kinds of terrible with it.
Oh, really?
I got about 1 million people I did this. That's where I get my coffee at home.
Oh, I didn't know. I thought, well, late.
Yeah.
Because the sun, that's why I'm
hopeful. Yeah.
It's very, very
fun. It's such a fun.
I'm a foodie.
So I know who I am.
You're going to come in?
Another.
Oh, we have a mutual friend. Yeah.
Oh, no, they're too old.
The only thing that's not really good for you is how many are
Imagine a lot of
Well, I would suggest,
although I'm reluctant to get started with my co-chair not here,
it's 8:30.
After.
8:30, it's a few minutes after, so I think we should get started because we have a lot more to cover today. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, members of the committee, for coming back after yesterday's experience. It's always a vote of confidence. And we do have a number of new members here. And we also have some new guests. So we just go around the room and everyone introduce themselves first among the committee members and then
our guests and speakers and members of the public afterwards. So I'll start. My name is Charlie Homer. CEO of the National Initiative for Children's Healthcare Quality, and with Marina White,
happy to go to
the Hi, everybody. I'm Rebo Inkorn, NQS staff.
Donna Prasad, Parkland Health and Hospital Assistant Pediatrics and
Health. Tom McInerney, Polisano Children's Hospital, University of Rochester Medical Center.
Phil Keeble, Vice President, Medical Affairs, Children's Minnesota.
Nancy, Medical Officer, Washington Healthcare Authority, and the Clinical Faculty, Pediatrics and
Washington.
Remind everybody, please use your mic. David Clark, Pediatric Cardiac Surgeon, Denver Children's Hospital, retired.
I'm Kathy Jenkins. I'm a pediatric cardiologist at the Children's Hospital in Boston and the Chief Safety and Quality Officer. And as I said yesterday, the Program for Patient Safety and Quality is the measure developer on the agenda for today. So I'll be recusing myself from that part of the discussion.
I'm Reed Barger, Senior Health Policy Advisor of the National Partnership for Women and Men.
I'm Faye Gary Chell, psychiatric nurse.
I'm Bonnie Dimmitt of Psychiatry, UCLA. I'm Sharon Doherty, the Duke University School of Nursing, and I'm representing the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners.
I'm Ralph from the University of Pittsburgh. I run the Pediatric Obesity Center at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh.
Alan Lieberthal, Kaiser Permanente, Panorama City, California.
I'm Ashley Morse, I'm NQS staff.
Hi, Al Gerson, the Senior Vice President of Performance Measures at NQF. Sorry I couldn't be with you yesterday. We had our board meeting. Kind of a hard thing to
Hi, I'm Suzanne Taverge, NQF staff.
Hi, I'm Bob Lee, Senior Director of Performance Measures at NQF.
Good morning, everyone. Nicole McElvin, NQF staff. We can now allow some of our guests to introduce themselves briefly.
Hi, I'm Jay Berry. I'm a general pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Boston.
Kim Cobro, also from Children's Hospital of Boston, a biostatistician.
I'm Craig Dillahy. I'm a pediatric surgeon at Children's Hospital of Boston.
Lisa Bergerson, pediatric interventionalist at Children's Hospital.
Hi, my name is Sonia Zinio. I'm the senior survey methodologist of the program and patient safety quality at clinical research programs at Children's Hospital of Boston.
And I have the privilege of serving as the steward for this group from Children's Hospital of Boston. I'm Nina Rasher. I'm the executive director of the program for patient safety and quality.
I'm Rita Munley Gallagher, Senior Policy Fellow in the National Center for Patient Quality at the American Nurses Association, and I have the privilege of supporting the work of the NQF Nursing Organization.
Operator, you can open up the conference line and we can allow some of the participants to call in to also introduce themselves.
All lines are open.
Do we have any steering committee members or audience members, measure developers who have called in to listen to our meeting today?
Yes, Mark Antman from the AMA PCPI.
Anybody else? Okay, I just wanted to quickly do a recap of our deliberations yesterday, and I was looking through some of the measures to try and really capture how many we passed, how many we would probably review on a future conference call, and how many we just, the committee just didn't feel were appropriate for endorsement. There were about three measures which you did recommend for endorsement. I'm sorry, did someone call in? There were actually three measures that we did review and move forward with endorsement on. That was the number of school days missed due to illness for children. Children who have no problems obtaining referrals when needed. And also, children who live in communities perceived as safe. Those are the three I have on my list. We also tabled a few measures. Some were due to allow the measure developer to provide some further clarifications on the measure, and others were the larger survey measure by the CME developer, and where Enter the Fact is going to work with CME to hopefully.
If we could ask the person on the phone who's calling in to put his phone on mute, we're hearing a good deal of static, which is broadcast over our speaker system. Thank you.
So we did look into those larger survey measures and gather the questions and some of the additional materials that you'll need to evaluate those. There were about three measures that were out of scope or either considered to be a process measure, which, again, we discussed yesterday, and possibly taking some of those measures and moving them on to the second phase of the child health project. And it looks like there was one measure that the committee agreed was not appropriate for endorsement, and that was the children living with illness and the effects of that condition on their daily life. So, again, we'll summarize all this information and get this out to the group in a meeting summary, but I just wanted to do a quick recap before we begin today. Helen, did you have any comments? Okay. So we're going to start with some of our more clinical measures, which will be a little bit of a change from yesterday. We are in work group one. So if you all have the materials either on your computer or printed, you can go ahead and pull up the table that we have compiled of the committee reviewers, their initial comments on this particular measure. The first measure we're taking up is number 27. And we do have our measure developers and a lovely team of folks back there who have worked on these measures. And did you all want to take some time? Yeah, I think
So would you like to,
Dr. Barry, would you like to briefly present the measure?
Sure, that'd be great.
Thanks very much for having me today. And it's been a great opportunity to develop this measure with our pediatric neurosurgeons at Children's. This measure reflects sort of a bread and butter procedure by the pediatric neurosurgeons there. And it's also very important to me I have a clinic that's full of children with special health care needs, especially those who are technology dependent, and we're seeing a lot of readmission rates around these children, especially with malfunctions. So that's why I was brought to the table to help these guys. It's been fun developing the measure. In terms of the neurosurgeons' acceptance of it, it seems that most neurosurgeons across the country feel that shunt malfunction is on their radar and it's something that they consider an outcome already. So the challenge for us was how to take that measure clinically and plug it into administrative data in order to pull out a valid measure. So we spent most of our time searching through the codes and figuring out the best way to do that, and then also looking at populations that might be at risk and case mix adjustment issues and trying to figure out how to risk adjust those things or whether to exclude them in the end. So there were a number of parts of the measure that we actually had built in initially as risk adjustment, and then we ended up excluding them to try to homogenize the measure a little bit. And that's why we've excluded populations with spina bifida and also with other types of shunts that can be placed that go not into the abdomen but into other places. We've been using the measure for a while at our hospital. It's been accepted, and the neurosurgeons feel like it's helped change their care and their approach to the operation. So
maybe I'd like to invite the other members of work group one initially to either make comments or ask the developers in areas, and I suggest we go through the sequence of the areas, the criteria that we need to do in order to approve. The first one being an indicator of the importance.
Dr. Berry, just a couple of questions. I mean, one of the questions that came up for me is not being familiar with this area clinically is how common is shunt malfunction. The other more important question from my standpoint is how much of shunt malfunction is actually due to procedural issues as opposed to something that has just happened spontaneously. You could address those.
Right. So in terms of the commonality of it, we think that probably you're looking at an overall average of around 10%. So 1 in 10 shunts are malfunctioning within 30 days of being placed. And in terms of the variability of that among hospitals, it seems that there's around a 4- to 5-fold difference in the variability. So you can look at rates that are going from like 3 to 25%. If you expand out beyond 30 days, we see rates that climb up a much higher than that. In terms of the quality of the operation and how that can affect the outcomes, the surgeons feel strongly that the biggest one of the largest indicators of the shunt survival is due to the actual placement. I mean, it actually is the angle and the insertion of the shunt into the brain and also into the abdomen, and the way that the shunt is routed to make sure that it's not at risk for being kinked or broken, or that somehow it's been placed that would impede the flow of cerebral spinal fluid. They also believe that there are a fair number of malfunctions that are due to infection. And so in the operating room, trying to increase the efficiency of the operation being performed, double gloving, antibiotics at the procedure, et cetera, are all process measures that they feel relate to the outcome. So they do feel that there's a strong bit of clinical happenings that are associated with the malfunction rates.
Could you just make one or two additional statements about the rates of infection and what kinds of complications that might cause? And the other issue is what are the professional healthcare providers help take care of these children? And did you get any feedback from them?
Sure. So in terms of infection, the prevalence rates of infection within the malfunction rates, you're probably going to have around a third to a quarter of these that will be associated with infection in terms of the ones that are malfunctioning. What infection means is that you likely have bacteria that are getting into the shunt. If the bacteria are inside of a shunt, that's a direct route into the brain. So essentially, when you're talking about an infected shunt, you're talking about treating a child with suspected meningitis. It's a problem. The shunt has to be taken out. You're looking at maybe a 14 to 21-day course of antibiotics. Externalizing the shunt, you've still got to deal with the pressure when the shunt is removed to make sure the kid's safe. And then you've got to put another shunt back in. So infection is a big deal, and they take it very seriously. In terms of the co-management, the other operating staff, in addition to the neurosurgeons, feel like they play a heavy role into the process. Again, they try to really streamline as much as they can in the operating room, the time of procedure, and time of completion. So having the surgical assistants there, and everyone else on board with exactly what's going on and making sure that they're comfortable with the procedure makes a difference. When the child is out of the operating room, then at our hospital, there is a good bit of co-management that goes on between some of the general and developmental pediatricians and the surgeons to help manage these children afterwards. Sometimes it's harder than you would think to determine whether a child actually has a shunt malfunctioning or not. And so when the child has symptoms that are suggestive of it, oftentimes the surgeons will consult with us if we know the children very well to determine if we're highly suspicious of that happening or not.
Dr. McInerney.
I think this is a terrific idea. It reminds me a little bit of what we've been able to do with central line infections that, we used to consider them, well, that's just part of putting central lines in, and now we know that if you do things correctly, you can avoid that. A couple of questions. I'm wondering, in Boston, are they using checklists when they're doing these?
Surgical checklist. I am not sure if they're using the checklist or not.
Yes. As one of the surgeons in the operating room in Boston, not a neurosurgeon, but checklist has become a part of.
Okay. Good. That should help. And two, essentially you're sort of providing a 30-day guarantee, and I'm wondering why you pick 30 and not, say, 60, 90, or 365 days. Any evidence to suggest, because, my experience has been 30 days, you may get some, but, another month or two or three later, you're going to get more. And so where do you draw the line, and can you perhaps extend it to more than just 30 days?
It's a great question, and we really argued about this for a while. So it seems that the majority of shunt malfunctions are occurring closer to the operation than later out. Now, if you do expand out to 60 or 90 days, you're going to pick up more signal. However, it was a little bit of a dance with the neurosurgeons in terms of how the quality of the operation was related to the outcome. So they sort of felt like, the further you're going out, the less likely it was associated with the previous operation. And so in that regard, we sort of negotiated and ended up on 30 days. However, I would say that I think that we are amenable to considering going out further if that's important to the group.
Thank you.
If I could also ask you questions right now, I'd like them focused on the importance question, particularly we can deal with some of the other issues as we go through. But go ahead.
All right. From my perspective, then I will concur that there is importance there. From I think most active children's hospitals, this is a major problem. And I think your data about anywhere from 3 to 20% or 25% is true. So for me, it is an important issue. Some hospitals, the hospitalists also take care of these patients post-op, as do our neonatal our pediatric nurse practitioner or hospitalists. So it crosses different aspect, different professions.
Dave,
just one issue that I'm not sure that the committee is really aware of is related to the importance of this measure is what are the implications of shunt failure, particularly acute shunt failure, from the standpoint of morbidity and mortality of the patient, and also the cost. My impression is most of these are emergencies, particularly when they occlude. Would you comment?
Thank you. So they are considered emergencies, and if not treated promptly, there is a high risk of death. If death does not occur, then you're looking at essentially a lot of permanent neurologic sequelae from pressure on the brain. In terms of the economic impact, we were able to go back and look at some of the HCUP data from ARC. That's been published on this, and it's estimated that there are probably around 10,000 admissions a year associated with shunt malfunction in children. And the mean cost of those admissions is around $17,000 to $20,000. So you're looking, I think, at around $200 million annually just in shunt malfunction admissions.
That's very helpful, David. That's kind of, that last point of kind of data that, that I was looking for in figuring out the importance. I do have, I mean, I understand the clinical importance and the frequency of shunts were put in that failed. One thing in the measure specifications, in your description, though, that concerns me is if it requires three-year running averages to come up with stable rates sufficient for conducting analysis of benchmarking, that, what are the implications of that in terms of really the frequency and our ability to use it to actually track changes?
So I was thinking more of the three-year running average, less in order to collect the numbers,
okay,
but more to stabilize the confidence intervals a bit. You're not trying to change or not change the quality of care that you're doing for these things just because of a quarter where you may have looked good or looked bad or maybe a year. So we thought that it stabilized the measure to me in terms of more of the variance than it did the actual signal. And that was sort of my approach to it.
I'd like to ask members of the group one why they chose partially rather than completely as far as impact. We went from yesterday these very broad measures that had value as far as populations and government to now a very operational small volume, but to this specialty, very important measure that is a true outcome measure. And I wanted to know why people considered it only partially meeting the impact.
For me, it was basically we didn't have frequency, we didn't have population prevalence data, we didn't have the financial data, we didn't have the three-year average concern me. I think this was a measure with a lack of improvability over time, or at least that I had, while there was the variation, it may be confusing with a different one where it had been tracked but there hadn't been changes, confusing it. But those were why I put it only in the partially rather than the completely area. So even if it was clinically, again, I'm operating a little on the assumption that NQF already has 600 measures, many of which are clinically accurate but relatively low prevalence conditions, so aren't going to have broad impact on changing. So that's why I wanted to make sure this was something that was not only sort of valid and clinically important for a very small subset, but actually was worthy of investing the resources in maintaining and continuing for a significant impact. That was my personal reason for only putting it in partially rather than completely.
Just one comment on the criteria and the way we wrote this specifically was that impact could either be in terms of broad impact, broad population, big numbers, or a small population with a significant impact on them. And so I think, you know, what part of what you've heard is the significant impact of a small population is quite reasonable as well.
My colleagues on
the stage. Yeah, I would say that that was really my learning curve over the past 2 days is that it had to do with the broad pop. I was thinking more of the impact broadly and now realizing that this is a very strong measure of a specific group.
My concern is, and I think Dr. Ferry's addressed it to some degree, is I was under the assumption that the vast majority of shunts are placed in a handful of hospitals, and therefore it would be harder to pick up variation. But it seems like there's a lot of different places where they're reported.
That's right. So going back to the HCUP data, not in the nationally weighted data, but in their actual sample from 38 states in 2003, there were over 300 pediatric hospitals that were performing these across the country. About 70% of those are considered by NACRI to be teaching hospitals in some way. 30% are community hospitals. So we think that there is a lot more bandwidth out there for this to be initially thought.
So, Tom?
Just a quick question. Is this somewhat similar to pediatric cardiac surgery in that the more you do, the better you are, the less you're going to have shunt failures?
So that is emerging. You know, the volume outcome relationship for this over time is emerging as in cardiac surgery, yes.
So just following our procedure, the first thing we need to do is vote on the importance of the threshold. We have to vote on the importance first, and then we can go on to discuss the other elements of the measure. So I'd like to have a vote on from the committee on whether this measure meets the threshold criteria for importance. All in favor, raise your hand.
Marlene, are you on the phone?
No. Great. It's everyone.
Okay. Yes, terrific. So it meets that criteria. So let's move on to discussion of scientific acceptability. Any members of the committee want to work group make any comments?
I have a couple of points that I'd like to ask about. Going back just tangentially to the 30-day issue, one of your data gathering points was reoperation for ventricloperitoneal shunt during the same hospital admission. I'm wondering, does the 30-day rule still apply in that situation? And I'd also like you to comment on the exclusion of children under 1 month of age or children with spina bifida, which are known risks for shunt failure that are, I guess at this time, considered non-preventable. But my concern about that is if you don't measure those kinds of things, they never become preventable. So because they're not identified. One of the things that's been applied, for example, in the STS database is that these things, the data is harvested, but these things are initially excluded from analysis until you determine exactly what their relationship is to the overall measure. Could you comment on those points?
Sure. So if a child receives an initial shunt that remains in the hospital past 30 days and has a shunt malfunction at 30 or greater days, and they're not counted. In terms of the age less than 1 month, we're understanding now that there's a lot of treatment variability going on across the country and how to manage hydrocephalus in those kids with modalities that lie in addition to VP shunts, which makes it more complicated to study. There's an endoscopic third ventriculoscopy and a reservoir of things the neurosurgeons know much more about than I do. But they felt like it was better to pursue what's actually going on among the treatment modalities for those kids than to single out shunts in those kids less than 30 days for the measure. They thought that it made it more homogenous across hospitals to exclude them. In terms of the spina bifida, I think you have a very valid point. So when we initially created the measure, we included spina bifida within the cohort, and we risk-adjusted for it. And then after some discussion, we thought it was best, again, to draw a nice circle around the measure and exclude the children with spina bifida because they weren't exactly sure what's going on and why their malfunction rates are so high. We did have discussion yesterday about whether it would be appropriate to have a subdomain measure for those kids. And I feel that would be important for something to us to do as we test the measure and move forward. I agree with you. If there's a lot of signal within that group, we should not exclude any of them.
What percentage do you know of children who have shunts placed for spina bifida?
Total. I think you're looking at around 10%, 10 to 15% at the most.
So, Jake, could you talk a little about the validity of assessment? So have you compared, for example, the chart review data with the FIS data, et cetera? So, just technical aspects of the measure.
That was our first step. The neurosurgeons at first did not trust administrative data whatsoever, which was a great process. Luckily, they were collecting their own. They had their own registry, which was nice. So they had all of their shunt patients lined up. And then we went through and correlated that with the administrative data from our hospital first. And that made them much more comfortable when they saw that the same patients were showing up. I don't have specific specificity or sensitivity data for you, but there was a litmus test of this works, and the neurosurgeons bought it, which made me feel good. It seems that the codes are okay. I mean, you know, to have a code that's specifically for
ventricular peritoneal shunt is very well circumscribed. There's not a lot of noise in that code from other things that can be thrown in. And to have the specific codes for shunt removal, shunt, revision, et cetera, I think they've done a nice job up front of sort of thinking about these codes. So we like the face validity of codes as they are.
Any other questions about different aspects? Ellen, please.
This may actually be a feasibility question, but the one question I had is about 30-day and whether they always come back to the same hospital, or how can you capture a 30-day rate if a child is admitted to a different hospital?
That's a very, very important question. So the data that you see before you captures only kids who come back to the same hospital. We pulled a number of neurosurgeons and did a few key informant interviews to just try to get a sense of could these kids go elsewhere. Because you could imagine if a kid lives in a more rural area, say, they have a shunt malfunction, they may not have time to come back to the tertiary care center where they were operated first. However, the surgeons feel strongly that the vast, vast majority of the time the kids are coming back to the same hospital.
So these data come from FIS database?
That's right.
And how, describe how you've applied this, or have you tested this with other discharge data that were not, since you said only 30? You said a very significant number of children have these procedures that are not in tertiary children's hospitals, so it would not be in the FIS database.
That's right. That's right. So beyond FIS, we know that using the HCUP and ARC data that the codes are being used across the country nationally. Now, the problem with the ARC data is that we do not have the ability to link patients across hospitalizations at the moment. However, there have been a few states that have been released in the last few months where they have their patient linker, which is allowing that process to occur with Claudia Steiner from ARC. And I think with the ultimate hope that they will be expanding out for longitudinal data as it grows over the next few years. So our next step, I think, is to look into that small sample of ARC data, have some of the community hospital cohort included, and start to test the measure there to see if the codes are lining up appropriately.
And there's somewhere in the specifications it says the measure hasn't been tested, but in fact you are using it. Sounds like maybe you're doing more than you gave yourself.
That's a good question, Charlie. I wasn't sure exactly what the testing meant. In terms of what we've done at our hospital, we have done the chart review. It has been plugged into FIS. We have looked at the rates and benchmarked and targeted against other hospitals, and we have acted on the data. So to a certain extent, we are using it. But in terms of the gold standard to me, if you're really going to test it, I think, would be to go out and do a multi-institutional chart review and validation process to make sure that there's not a lot of coding variability, et cetera, and that hasn't been performed.
So really it was just performed at your institute when you said you compared it to registry data, and that was really only within your own.
Exactly. Right.
I have a question is relative to your three-year rolling data plan. Does that apply only to single institutions, or if you're implementing it more broadly, in other words, if the entire group of 70 institutions, academic institutions, are participating in the measurement, does that modify your need to do that?
This is a great question. I think it depends on what you're going to use the data for, what's the actionability of the data. I think if you're looking at a population level of are we getting better with shunt care, are we decreasing the malfunction rates, I don't think you need a three-year rolling average. I think you can do that on the population data with a year of data and be fine. I think, however, if you're trying to look at yourself and say, within this cohort of hospitals, are we doing better? Are we doing worse? Are we in the middle? Do we need to think about changing or not changing our care? Then I do like to incorporate the variance surrounding that measure and making sure that before I say that my hospital has worse malfunction rates than hospital B, that I sort of look around the noise of that signal and make sure it's not due to the noise, but it is the signal. So I would say go for the 3-year if you're doing that.
Just one more technical question on this, and then we'll, I think, probably move on to vote on this. Have you looked at disparities issues? Have you looked at variation in rates across different populations?
We did. And this is what we found. So in our bivariate analyses, we found that non-Hispanic blacks have higher rates of shunt malfunction compared to whites. Now, when we threw that into a multivariate model, controlling for other things, the effect went away. So I'm not sure if there's something there or not. And at this point, I feel that it was best not to call it and put it into the measure. However, if people are thinking that it's important to present within the measure subdomains rates within different race ethnicity groups, we're certainly amenable to doing that.
I mean, the NQF process is to stratify results by different populations rather than adjust. So, okay, point is, again, you looked at it and that it's feasible to look at it within the data set. That
yes.
That's what's important from an NQF perspective.
Can I just jump in? Going back to the evaluation criteria, which all of you have been working off of and rating all these measures, the key piece on testing, I want to make sure you all understand why staff rated this as not tested, is it hasn't had reliability testing that tests retests or some type of look, and it hasn't gone through any validity testing as well, which is something that you all can decide is okay for this measure, but we would really feel that it needs to have a time-limited endorsement, which means they have 12 months, or we'll negotiate with them, I think sometimes it takes a little longer, to come back and provide that information. I think the key piece that we are always want to make sure is any measure you put out there for public reporting, anyone else who goes and does the same thing with the specifications that they provide can be replicated to the greatest extent possible. We don't know that yet, that you can with the way this measure is specified. So that's really, I think, why we had it labeled as needing time-limited endorsement. Does that make sense to everyone?
I think AQF quite appropriately is strength-tightening the criteria. I certainly, this is more tested than a number of measures I know when I was on the ambulance.
Yeah.
We sort of kind of think this is a good idea, and we could actually pull the data that was viewed as testing. And this one has been validated in one site, but not in multiple sites. And test retest, and this seems like that, with administrative data, I'm not sure that concept is really quite applicable, but that's probably get too deep into the weeds.
And I'm sorry, we could also take just a closer look at the testing and give back the children as well, just to be sure.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I was less worried about the validity than the reliability, and that there should be some form of measure that across sites people are going to have access to.
Right.
So in terms of,
well, I guess we go through all the criteria and then we'll go through. So should we move? Let's move on to, and we may have already addressed this, the usability.
So
do you want to vote on each section?
Yeah.
Okay, I forgot it. Okay, so then to vote on the scientific acceptability, how many feel it is completely meets criteria? And how many feel it partially meets criteria?
Well,
did that get everybody, or are we down to minimally?
No, that should be it.
All right. So moving on to usability. That is it understandable? Is it harmonized? Are there any other measures out there that does it provide added value? Comments from the work group on that?
I think I would like to ask, you said you are using it at your institution, so what I want to know is what has happened since you started the measure? What has happened to your rates, and what have you done?
So since starting the measure, I think the first thing that happened is there was a little bit of Hawthorne effect going on. which was fantastic. And I think it just got people thinking about malfunction. And it also had non-neurosurgeons thinking about malfunction as well. I mean, our hospitalists, other people, when they were admitting to our service, they would say, Jay, we had another kid that was readmitted with a shunt malfunction, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it created a lot of buzz. The second thing that happened is that the neurosurgeons really felt like they needed to streamline the amount of time it was taking to perform these operations initially in the OR, that they really need to have a core competency within a small group of staff in the OR to make sure the operation was right. So they've actually tried to decrease the number of personnel that are physically in the room during the operation, because they feel like the more people that are there, strictly adding another person, may increase the risk of the child having an infection. So they really are trying to make a difference. We have seen some small decreases in our rates. Now, if you look at the confidence intervals around that, they haven't changed significantly, but we have seen a little decrease in our signal since the measure was put on board.
Greater awareness.
Any further questions about usability? All right, so what do we call a vote on how many shields completely meets usability criteria?
I get 13.
That's everybody, right?
No. You're a partial. I was going to say, I keep looking at Ellen back there.
Ellen, are you a complete or partial?
Partial.
All right, so let's move on to the feasibility. And I think you've already addressed many of the questions there, which is that it's feasible within the FIS database, maybe feasible the other ones, but hasn't been, but because of the idea of whether you can actually track individuals over time, hasn't yet been applied. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I think that's the data that you're going to need to really establish your targeting and benchmarking. I mean, I would hope that most hospitals across the country have enough admin data in terms of, for every admission, they have the procedures and the diagnoses that occur in order to bill for them, that they have an internal structure which from their admin data they can pull their own rates. So I think you're looking at more of the national databases than to determine, okay, how well are we doing compared to other hospitals?
What exactly is the FIS database?
So the FIS database is a database of inpatient hospitalizations for 42 freestanding children's hospitals across the country. It's unique in that the patients are linked across multiple encounters. And so you can track a patient over time to see the number of times they're hospitalized. And for each admission, you have the diagnoses and procedures that occurred, demographics, et cetera, which allow you to pull data such as this.
Patients are not do not receive the procedure at one of these 42 hospitals. Their own administrative data would have to be used. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you're basing this on assumptions. They have accurate databases that they can pull data from.
Yes, some type of administrative billing database that the hospital would use for their coding, which would be the same that FIS is pulling from our hospital. It's the same sort of core data set. So the assumption would be that they have that same similar data set.
I'd like to ask if there exists a neurosurgical society-based database that would cover this issue, and would that be useful?
Yes. So one product that has emerged from this work to start is the creation of a multi-institutional hydrocephalus collaborative, which is now being started up by John Kessel in Utah. And one of the collaborators in some of our work, Tamara Simon. It's really good stuff. Prospective data collection, looking at very, very specific variables around quality of care, around the shunt procedure, and hopefully we'll see data from them in the next year or two.
Great. I'd like to make a comment about this. In the state of Washington, we've been doing collaboratives like this. We've done it around cardiovascular surgery. We're now including some things in cardiology and PCI. We've done it around surgical procedures that we thought, like for appendectomies, you ought to be able to do an appendectomy, and we were quite surprised to see the variation. And one of the things is that we have used the three-year rolling average, and it does eliminate problems when people think that they are being unfairly, targeted for something that, you know, it happened. The core thing that we found that was going on when you started looking at administrative data was, one is the people that were extracting the data. And we even got asked by the hospitals to send out people to make sure that we could look at this and do validation on it. The other thing is, when you first start out, is whether people take it. If you're collecting the data, they say they will if they take it seriously. And they have been pinged and looked bad because they did sloppy data collection. But all you have to do is be pinged and you put yourself back together. The other thing is that I found good about what he was saying is if you want to go into different hospitals, what we found out is the key is to get a physician in that specialty to be your champion. And that's the way to get in. And this is one way. I mean, I'm very glad that you realized about the data and stuff, because yeah, the first thing we had to do was get this data. People got sick of hearing about it, so that we answered everybody's questions about the data so they could believe, yeah, maybe you do have a problem. And I'm really happy to hear that you're going to do a collaborative about this.
Just a quick question, sort of suggestion. As more and more hospitals migrate to electronic medical records for both their inpatients and their outpatients, would you foresee that maybe sometime in the future you would be able to use that data and get rid of the administrative data?
Oh, boy. That would be absolutely fantastic. I mean, to move beyond codes, to move into a lot of clinical detail, the size of the shunt that is placed, the time in the operating room, you know, very, very specific clinical details going into it will trump this stuff like no tomorrow. So I can't wait for that day.
All right, so in terms of feasibility, should we call a vote how many feel this completely meets criteria for feasibility?
I get five.
Partially?
Fine. Okay, that works.
All right, so now is time to call a vote on the overall NAVSER. I think the recommendation hearing from staff would be that this should be recommended for time-limited approval pending additional testing, and I think particularly the idea of looking at validity across in multiple institutions and potentially expansion beyond the CHCA data set seem to be the two areas we'd like to see additional testing on.
There's no specificity about the time.
No,
it's 12 months.
It's
generally 12 months. But we can, if there's a little wiggle room, we can do it.
Okay. So all those in favor of conditional approval.
Okay.
Time limited approval. Thank you.
I'm Andrew Blackout of the discussion regarding when children get readmitted from different institutions, and if it's possible to work that out in a follow-up period. So the FIS, I don't remember what he said, there's a way to do it with the FIS database, but it'd be cleaner to where you not only from the institution where you did the surgery, if you readmit to another hospital, or shunt malfunction, you can get that into the data. I mean, it may not be doable just yet, but
If they do that collaborative, it would be.
Yeah, if they do the collaborative, I guess they could.
Good question. I guess that's the challenge of not having a Medicare database that they can't track individuals across. Okay. So something during the test period to occur.
And then speaking for Marlene and her absence over the toolkit issue, since this group has a checklist already where the win measure published. The checklist to become available, or the thought, I guess the collaborative would probably come up with tools for having better rates.
So that's a question, I think, for Helen, which was Marlene.
Can I just ask the measure developer to come in?
Sure. But just sort of more as a policy or process, Marlene Miller suggested yesterday that when we approve or consider a measure, that the idea of linking that to a quality improvement toolkit, and I didn't know whether InterWeb had considered part of its process making those available together with their...
That's what we did yesterday, Mom.
We haven't done that to date, but we are moving towards trying to create this relational database. We're calling it the half measures of practices. It'll try to package everything together. Saying, here's the measure, here's the practice, here's related information. It's all going to be developed.
So, Jay, there were really two sets of questions that were raised. One was the idea of linking across institutions, so a child gets operated at Boston Children's and shows up at, you know, some other institution in town, for example. Would that be, is there the capability, or at least can you look during the testing period at that potential look at that? Was one of the questions.
I think we should explore it. I'm wondering, I think that ARC may actually have more data that's just not publicly available yet, and I feel comfortable talking with them and asking them if we could do something like that for review the state and patient databases and merging them together.
And the other question was, building on conversation we had yesterday, was the desirability of linking measures with quality improvement-related toolkits. And NQF is in the process of putting together a database that would, you know, you could just queue up your issue with, you would link a variety of things. So just more expression of interest in that toolkit being made broadly available as the collaborative moves forward.
Sounds great.
Did I capture that sound?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That would be great.
Okay, moving on to our next measure, measure 28. This is the standardized mortality ratio for neonates undergoing non-cardiac surgery. This is the ratio of observed to expected rate, ratio of observed to expected rate of in-hospital mortality following non-cardiac surgery among infants less than 30 days of age and risk adjusted. So this is, again, under the same group, and we'll open it up for importance.
But should we ask the presenter
absolutely.
To describe the measure? And maybe I haven't heard the having heard the conversation before, maybe sort of focusing some of your comments on some of the sort of sequentially thinking about the importance of the measure and the scientific credibility, et cetera, that would be great.
Certainly, I can try to do that. Together with Kim Gavro, a statistician, I'm a pediatric surgeon, and together developed this model. One of the problems that we face in surgery is obviously an ability to risk adjust, and that's particularly of a problem in pediatric surgery, where we have a wide variety of different sort of problems that present in children. What we have done is on a variety of different diseases, we'll pick a disease and then study that either in a particular institution or across institutions. But again, it's limited to that, whether it's gastroschisis or omphalocele or diaphragmatic hernia, necrotizing enterocolitis, a variety of those studies have been done. We were looking for a broader measure and, specifically a broader measure to look at neonatal surgery, so that as you see in our measure, we're focusing on operations that occur within the first 30 days of life. Those are primarily congenital lesions, but again, they are infrequent. Surgery in children is fortunately rare, and in order to develop a risk adjustment method, we used a strategy where we could combine procedures of similar risk. Now, in order to do that reliably, we chose, first of all, we chose to use a large national database. So this is based on the KIDS 2000, where we've developed the model. And within that, we focused on procedures that had at least 20 cases, where in those circumstances where there were just a handful of cases, we didn't feel that that gave us a reliable tool for assessing risk. So they are limited to cases that are greater than 20 cases, and of those, there are 63 different procedures that are included out of the total of some 570, something like that. But in fact, those 63 cases account for almost 85% of all the procedures done. So we think it is based on a large sample from that KIDS database. With that, then, to take you through the rest of the model, we developed risk categories based on that. And then as a measure, we thought the most reliable measure, and in fact, in many ways, the most important measure for us was in-hospital mortality. So that was something that we could measure that we felt was reliably reported even within an administrative database and would allow us to make assessments from institution to institution and risk adjust appropriately. Kim?
I don't have anything more to add at this time.
Members of the work group, questions again, probably start maybe first your observations and then questions starting on the importance first.
Sure. I think that my concerns and observations were actually the second lengthy comment up there. It's just, I'm not sure how many children actually undergo surgery in the neonatal period. And the incredible variety of procedures, even 63 procedures, seems like it's too heterogeneous to mix together. And finally, just looking at the data that you had, only one hospital had a significantly different rate of neonatal mortality listed there. So if you could address some of those points.
There's no question that the heterogeneity of cases is a challenge in making that assessment of neonatal surgery, newborn surgery. But I think the most telling thing about that is that, in fact, when we made this analysis, we derived it in the KIDS 2000 base and then validated in the 2003 that our ROC curve, that it was actually quite reliable, that 92.92 was the area of the curve with our ROC curve, so that showed that we really were able to reliably risk adjust in this population. So to be sure, it's a challenge, and there is a considerable heterogeneity, but in fact, the results seem to underscore that.
Just the second question of the lack of variability. Can you describe the variability across sites and its
We presented a table where you saw of 15 different institutions, and I think what you could see within that table is there was a considerable variability from institution to institution. However, you're quite correct, it was only one in which that achieved statistical significance. So it may be that by virtue of the fact that we are dealing with small relatively small numbers, that we would need a larger time period to accrue greater numbers and highlight some of those differences from institution to institution.
Right. We were only looking at 1 year of data in that case, so maybe something like we were talking about with the previous measure, maybe it needs to be a two-year measure or a three-year measure. We have started looking at this method a little bit in the FIS database, and in that case we were using 3 years of data to look, and the confidence intervals are narrower in that case.
I was wondering across the 15 different institutions.
We really can't hear you.
Across the 15 institutions and collectively, do you have data about the mortality for subgroups of populations, African Americans, American Indian, Hispanic, etc.? Do you have those data, and if you do, could you share those with us? Collectively, and if you see a variability across the 15 different institutions.
No, you cut to the core of it. The most exciting thing about this method for us is the ability to look at that administrative database, which will have access to things like race, insurance, type of hospital, those sorts of. But I don't have that data for you today, no.
Those data are forthcoming?
Well, that's something that we're working on right now. We've developed that model for just that reason, to be able to look at those sorts of issues. You bet. Tom?
I think we all know that mortality in children, even in neonates, is so rare that it makes it difficult sometimes to come up with significant differences. I wondered if you've looked at, if you could say, a combination of morbidity and mortality, such as needing a second operation or getting an infection, and if you might then be able to get a bit more variability in the data by adding in morbidity to mortality.
To be sure, it would be the more we know and understand of how that surgery impacts on children, the more valuable that becomes. The problem for us, or the challenge for us, is that in administrative databases, they have certain limitations of which you're all quite aware, and we really felt that what we wanted to be able to generate is a very reliable method for assessing that risk, and we thought that as such, mortality is the most reliable measure to do that.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I've been there and tried to do that, and it's tough. The one thing that on my first run through of the application that I came across that I think is a fatal flaw, but it apparently is not, potentially a fatal flaw, is basing the total project on operative cases. Cases don't die. Patients do. And when you have patients who have multiple procedures, particularly, this becomes an extremely unreliable method of measurement. But I was talking to Kim a little earlier, and apparently this is not exactly true.
We perhaps didn't make that clear enough in our application. But in fact, no, it does refer to specific patients. And when a patient has more than one procedure, which obviously is a not uncommon occurrence, what they are assigned to the risk category, the highest risk category associated with those procedures.
So the mortality is only attributed to one procedure, because otherwise you wouldn't know what you were talking about.
Correct.
The other question that I had was the ordinary criteria for operative mortality is either death during the same hospital admission or death prior to 30 days. And I'm wondering whether your limitation on data is the reason that is not included, or whether it would just be so rare in the neonatal population that a child would die within 30 days of operation, but after hospital discharge, that it's probably unnecessary to look at that. Can you comment?
Well, fortunately, it's rare, but to be sure, in-hospital mortality was once again what we felt was the most reliable piece of data that we could gain from that administrative database. So that's why it was chosen.
And also because the database we were using didn't allow us to link multiple admissions on the same patient. So if a patient was discharged, was readmitted, and died subsequently, we wouldn't know that.
My concerns were similar to David's, in that I was trying to make sure I understood that the mortality associated with these infants could be directly related to the surgery, and not, you know, other things that happen, the other morbidity that's associated with this age group being hospitalized. But you're pretty certain that you will be able to, that the database will be able to link that mortality specifically to their surgical outcomes and not iatrogenic things for infants in hospitals.
Or their pathophysiology.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. A couple of different things. Number one was that we looked at a variety of different clinical variables that might impact on outcome, mortality in this case, and there were only two that showed up in that, and that was serious respiratory diseases and and necrotizing enterocolitis. And they are included, those two clinical variables, and only those two are the ones that are included in our model and are part of this risk adjustment method.
Just to focus the conversation, it's been a fantastic conversation, but again, the first question we want to ask is this important enough? Is it either prevalent enough or for a certain population, important enough for us to feel that it's worth proceeding with the review of the other detailed attributes of the measure?
As the measure is currently structured.
As the measure is currently structured.
I have a question. Do we have to rely on what's present in the application, or do their comments, contribute? Because it changes everything.
The comments count.
The comments count.
That's why they're here. So your main concern was this issue of if there were multiple surgical procedures done.
Right, and using procedures as, your basis, and then you have multiple procedures per patient, and then you try to attribute mortality to what procedure, that, it was not clear how that was going to be handled, but the way that it's being handled, I think, is perfectly appropriate.
So going back to this question of in-hospital mortality versus a 30-day kind of mortality figure, have either you or anyone else looked at sort of basically a survival curve post-surgery of when poor children who do die post-surgical, when that actually happens, and whether how many or what proportion of deaths might be, a child went home and an untoward event happened and they ended up being rehospitalized? Do you have any sense, either from this analysis or from Medicaid claims or other cohort studies or anything like that?
Yeah, no, Trommer, I don't think we have beyond own experience as a pediatric surgeon that when children die within the neonatal surgery, that's typically they don't make it home.
Right,
so typically. Yeah. Nancy, please. I think I just need a little bit more clarification, because what I'm trying to see is, first of all, my understanding is that there's a small percentage of kids that die from surgeries in this age in pediatric hospitals, that we're looking at a small number of people, and then you start talking about things like gastroschisis operating on, neck operating on. My question is, you have to operate on those kids with gastroschisis or they will die. And so my question is, what exactly are you trying to get at to improve? I'm just sort of confused about it, because it's not like you have a choice. Have you run some data, and what you're going about is the kids who died from the operation because it was really the infection, it wasn't the procedure. If you don't have a choice about operating on somebody, you have to operate.
I think part of the question that you have.
I was just going to add the piece of information that in the database, in the kid database that we looked at to develop the model, there were about more than 5,000 neonatal surgeries, and that it does not encompass all states, and that's only an 80% sample of cases. So we were able to extrapolate that probably somewhere between 9,000 and 10,000 surgeries happen in the United States each year.
If we think of the last presentation on shunts, those children need their shunts too. So the question is there variability? Children will need surgery for their gastroschisis or the other conditions. And the question is there variability in mortality rates across institutions that presumably is attributable to some element of the care that they're receiving in those institutions? I think that's fundamentally, is there improvability based on variability across institutions for kids who need surgical procedures?
I see this a little bit different from the last one, and I just can't get my hands around you know, to me, I mean, I just can't even get my hands around how you're going to improve it. Maybe it's because the other ones that said they had looked at it, and they said that when they did the procedure, it was the angle at which they did the, they put the shunt in. And I can see that it's a device that you're putting in someone, and the device could malfunction, or you could do something to the device. And I'm not seeing that with these procedures. I guess that's the difference.
Well, I think that your point's well taken, that this is not a specific surgical, telling an individual surgeon or identifying even an individual surgeon as to whether it's their specific outcome, but we're really looking at a broader level at an institution, all of those things that, that impact on successful surgery in neonates. And what we anticipate is that, in fact, we will see variability, whether it's from institution to institution, whether it's socioeconomic groups, whether it's regions, and to understand by identifying that variability, then hopefully we can move to the next, which is to say, how can we impact on that? How can we change that? Whether it's access to care, whatever that might be. But you're right. What we're looking at is for what that variability is, and then how we might use that to change practice.
I just have a quick question, please. And that is, I know we were, the study involved 15 hospitals.
Actually the study, we just gave you data, a table of 15 hospitals for the evaluation form. In fact, this is, we've applied it to the entire KIDS database, which is surgery in what, 37 states that provide data to the KIDS, and we've actually applied to the FIS as well. So no, our intent, this is population-based.
Well, then I just amend my question just a little bit. I was wondering if you also have any data or will have any data about the basic characteristics of the hospitals or the populations that these hospitals serve. Because I think that based on the populations that they serve, you'll probably see some influence with the outcome. How will you address that issue?
Absolutely. Those are elements that are available in the KIDS database. So that will, the nice thing about using this database is it will allow us to interrogate just those sorts of questions about what other factors that related to those patients.
That's just one more observation, and maybe the NQF staff can help me on this. I see this as analogous to the hospitalized standardized mortality rate measure in adults, not precisely the same, because that's overall hospital. But do you have, I mean, my understanding is you probably do have on the adult side some indicator of hospital-specific mortality rate or standardized mortality rate that you use as an overall performance measure or not?
No. Well, if you're talking about multiple surgery across-the-board kind of measure, is that what you're talking about for adults in surgical measure?
Well, I know, again, at the IHI, they certainly use them as quality.
We have not brought in any HSMR measures. Not HSMR measures that come to NQF. All of our mortality measures tend to be procedure efficient. Although we do have composites of selected mortality.
And another part of the project, the main steering committee is reviewing a surgical complications, which includes mortality, but also other serious morbidities for all of the HSC-5 patients. So that it encompasses a wide variety of surgeries. So we're getting there.
Charlie, there is the NISQIP, National Surgery Quality Improvement Program, which adult surgeons, but there is now also a pediatric NISQIP that's up and running. I don't know if they reported any data yet. They're still collecting. So this is going to be similar.
So then why don't we vote on the, if there are no questions further, let's vote on the importance question. So all those who feel, again, this is a
dichotomous, yes, this is sufficiently important based either on its prevalence or within a narrower clinical area, which this presumably isn't, but within a narrower clinical area, whether it's an important measure. So all those who feel this meets the importance criteria,
Raise your hand.
I get 13.
Okay, and all of those who do not feel this meets the criteria have one.
Okay, yeah. Kathy recused.
I think we've already had a good bit of discussion, but let's move on with any additional questions or observations related to the scientific acceptability of the measure. Are there further either observations from the work group or questions from any members of the committee around the scientific?
Yeah, I'm still having trouble with the risk adjustment model. There's such a broad variety, and there's so many underlying conditions that affect it, that I don't know that the risk adjustment is adequate to give good information.
So, Kim, could you tell us about, first of all, how the risk adjustment, how the panel created the risk adjustment measure, and then perhaps for some of us whose statistics are a little rusty, describe what ROC curve in the area under the ROC curve means and things like that.
So the risk adjustment, the risk categories were derived primarily empirically in that we looked in the data set, the KID 2000 data set, and looked at four procedures that occurred at least 20 times in that data set. We looked at the in-hospital mortality rates. And then we grouped procedures by those rates. We started out with more than four categories, so looking at lots of possible different splits in the data, but knowing that we somehow wanted to group procedures by mortality rates. We then sort of worked backwards and looked at adjacent categories, and if there was not much overlap between them, would collapse them. We did that both looking at actual mortality rates and by putting things into logistic regression models and looking at odds of in-hospital mortality relative to what we considered to be the baseline group. And for the baseline group, we from the very beginning said that we were going to include procedures with a less than 2% mortality rate. There were a lot of procedures that didn't have any mortality in the database at all, but we would not be able to fit our regression models. We had a category with no deaths, so we wanted to be sure we would have at least some deaths, even in our baseline risk category. And so then we looked at the various cut points and found the one with the best discrimination. And that was measured by the C statistic, or area under the ROC curve, which basically is a measure of how well the model is able to predict who dies and who doesn't die. And just with the four risk categories that we ended up with alone, the area under the ROC curve was, I believe, 0.87. And in general, anything over 0.8 is considered very good. So the model, the risk categories, were very highly discriminative about predicting in-hospital mortality in this case.
And then you retest,
you validated.
We validated that in a second data set, the KID 2003, and found the area under the ROC curve to be, I believe in that case, was 0.85 or 0.86. I mean, just only a little bit less. And I guess we haven't mentioned it on top of that. So in addition to the risk categories, we did look at these other clinical factors that might contribute and help us to predict risk of in-hospital mortality even beyond the risk categories. And that was the necrotizing enterocolitis and serious respiratory conditions. We considered a list of about 10 or 15 other variables that might help contribute to risk and found only those two to be statistically significant.
Just a quick question, just because this untested outcome measure makes me a little anxious. How does this relate, is a reference you've got at the bottom of 2A to an article that's in the Annals of Surgery in Press? Is that the risk model you're talking about with the validation?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Because I think there's at least the comfort zone to know the risk model used in this particular measure has been validated. Yes?
Yeah, it was just published last month in the Annals of Surgery.
Okay, it still doesn't press.
Yeah. Sorry.
other questions about the scientific acceptability of it or comments from the work group members? So it sounds like some concern about the risk adjustment issue. Coding issues, probably any sense of the validity of coding, any concerns? I mean, death seems like it's pretty reliably coded, and the procedure itself seems like it's going to be pretty reliably coded, and that's basically all you need for.
I actually have a question about that. I just wondered how, aside from factoring out the cardiac procedures, is everything else in that bucket, or did you make some selections about what you included in the non-cardiac surgery compendium or inventory?
Yeah, I don't know that we've provided that table, but yes, there were procedures that we viewed as closed procedures. So I can list sort of a sample of that for you here. But the excluded procedures were any closed biopsies, closed reductions, superficial lacerations, catheterizations, dilatations, injections, aspirations, radiologic procedures, dental extractions, circumcision, and other incidental procedures. So yes, you're right. Of those procedures, there were certain ones that we excluded because we didn't think that they would really fit under the umbrella of neonatal surgery as we were trying to understand risk and mortality.
We can provide a copy of the article for the committee if you would like that. Okay.
I'd like to ask since you excluded a number of very minor procedures, why you included lingual phrenotomy as a significant condition?
Yeah, and fair enough. We can talk through one or the other, but in fact, most of the time, those procedures now are actually done, unlike perhaps an earlier era when they were done in the pediatrician's office, kind of the clipping at the bedside. Now, most often, in fact, they're done in the hospital and usually in an ambulatory setting with some element of anesthesia. And we really, anesthesia and a surgical team, we felt that was kind of the bar that put us in. Into this category, but I'm open to.
I'm sorry, I thought you said there actually did need to be some deaths for it to be included in your risk. I misheard that.
So we wanted our lowest baseline risk category to at least have some deaths so that we could compare the other categories to that one. In the end, the mortality rate in that category one was 0.2%.
No, but to answer your question,
procedures
yes. Individual procedures didn't need to have deaths.
That's
no,
right. Just in the category.
Just in the category.
Yes.
And again, this issue of meaningful differences, so your sense simply is because you've only done it 1 year and don't have multiple year averages, that your confidence intervals are sufficiently wide. So if this were used trended over time, perhaps that would result in significant narrowing. All right, again, my next question is towards usability. Any other questions on scientific acceptability, or we could move ahead and vote on that or comment?
I just want to make one comment. Even in cardiac surgery, where there's 20-fold differences in the country, it's extremely unusual in pediatric sample sizes to find statistical differences. I actually think it's extremely amazing that in a single year of data we did find any institution that was statistically different with an area under the ROC curve of 0.9. So I think perhaps having looked at rare pediatric procedures and outcomes more than maybe people who do more work on more common procedures, people may not be aware of that.
If I might comment, I think that the kind of AUC numbers that they're giving us are absolutely incredible.
Yes.
With the kind of broad categorization that we see here. I'm very, very surprised at that, but that's really excellent.
All right, so why don't we go ahead and vote on the scientific acceptability. Those who would consider the criteria completely met, raise your hand.
One, all right.
Okay. Those who feel they're partially met?
One, two, three, four, eight, nine. Okay.
minimally?
Okay.
Got everybody?
Okay. Usability. So, I think there, one question I'd ask is,
has there been interest in the surgical community around this measure, and how does it seem to be received, and how understandable has there been, again, comparing a little with the previous conversation, as you vetted this with your colleagues at the hospital, as you've discussed in the CHCA or NACRI meetings or meetings, surgical society meetings, what kind of interest is there in this? What kind of reactions are you getting? Just to get some flavor for the usability of the measure.
Well, in fairness to you, we're pretty early on in that. In fact, the surgical community, at least at large, are only those who have read the last month's annals thus far. So, but in fact, within the surgical community and specifically the pediatric surgical community, we are, as a group, very interested in understanding reliable ways of risk adjusting for what we do, and then. Making things better accordingly. Now, to date, we've done that with specific diseases like congenital diaphragmatic hernia registries or neck sizing enterocolitis working group. But there are certainly limitations to that analysis and questions that you really don't lend themselves to answering in that context. There is the pediatric NISQIP that was alluded to earlier that's being developed in an effort to allow us to better understand what we do and how we might change things accordingly. But in fact, specifically as regards our measure, no, we're just in the process of springing it on them, if you will.
Okay. Were there any work? You weren't on the any other members of work? No, go ahead.
If I'm understanding this correctly, looking at it from the consumer perspective, this has the potential to be a very powerful measure in the sense that I believe what you're trying to do is develop an overall measure of predictability of mortality of children prior to 30 days of age from non-cardiac surgery. It's perhaps one of the two or three most powerful kinds of measures that anybody wants to know about a hospital. And I guess it would be helpful to me if you would just take a minute and explain how you would explain this to a patient or a purchaser as a good predictor of whether I should hospitalize my child or have that hospital in my neck. Too tall an order?
No, or Don Berwick. How would you explain to Don Berwick?
In his new role, or potential new?
We do think that this has the potential for a considerable impact. Obviously, results of neonatal surgery, for those of us who look after neonates or have neonates or whatever, is exceedingly important. And we do think that with this tool, we will be able to dissect out whether it's institution-specific, whether it's types of institution, whether freestanding pediatric hospitals do better or not, or whether a children's hospital within a large general hospital is a children's unit within that neonatal surgery is the same, whether anesthesiologists that are the ability to have access to pediatric anesthesiologists makes a difference versus not. I don't know the answer to those questions, and we may be surprised by some of the results, to be sure, but yeah, I think that that's why we're excited about this particular study.
Well, of course, you know, for adult cardiac surgery, this kind of reporting has been going on for at least a decade. But my impression, correct me if I'm wrong, is that as far as either purchasers or consumers are concerned, whether they even know the data, number one, and whether it makes any difference where they decide to go, number two, I haven't seen a lot of evidence that it has influenced that. Maybe I'm wrong.
the data on these kind of things tends to influence providers a great deal.
Yes.
So that's even though the expectation, of course, was that consumers use it to drive, what frequently happens is hospitals and physicians are very driven by comparative data. We all didn't want to be in the bottom of our classes, and therefore we look at these data and intend to drive improvement through that strategy more than.
I think we all know that. And of course you're in the state that's in the leader in tertiary reporting. But I think in fact it has impacted some of the purchasing patterns in interstate. And my understanding also, we haven't actually done a lot of testing with this yet. So we'd be presumably talking about this as a time limited. Yeah, because I would want to get a little better sense of how much variability we're really churning out.
Alan, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. And I'm looking for the exact wording, but you said something about to be included, you have to have more than 20 procedures. Is that correct?
That's right.
Is that of 20 individual procedures or 20 in a risk category?
20 in an individual surgical procedure.
Okay. One of my concerns about usability is that if there are institutions that are doing fewer than 20 and they're excluded from the data.
Let me clarify, because I think we're leading you in the wrong direction. When we developed the model, in order to develop the model, what we used were procedures in the KIDS database that were more 20 or more, okay? Procedures in the KIDS database that did not have 20 procedures, okay? We did not include in our risk category. We didn't put them into a specific risk category. So do we omit certain rare procedures? Indeed, we do. But the fact of the matter is our analysis encompassed about 85% of the types of procedures being done. So that was just to develop the model.
So the hospital doesn't.
So hospitals that are doing fewer than 20 procedures still would be part of this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That answers my question.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question, and it's related to Lee's question. Lee asked about how the data will impact decisions for administrative decisions, et cetera, et cetera. And my question is, have you all given any thought to how your outcome data can be used or will be used when communicating with consumers, i.e. parents and family members? Could you just talk about the usability of this data as it relates to, I think, one of the most important groups, and that is the parents of the child? I'm trying to get a translation here to how it appears in the clinical setting with a variety of different kinds of parents and families who might have this experience.
Of course, well taken. And obviously, that's a decision that as a parent looking to a surgical procedure, that's paramount in your mind. This data is really by virtue of the fact that we're including a lot of different types of procedures and combining those risk categories, we're really not looking at individual operations. So I don't think this is a tool for that individual parent to decide whether I'm going to have Dr. Littlehigh do my hernia repair or not based on that. It's talking about institutions as a whole, whether we think that institution specifically, or that type of institution, or that region of the country. Those are the sorts of questions that we'll be able to answer about this, and not the specific one, you know, where do I get my hernia fixed, or with whom. So there are, I just wanted to underscore that limitation of what we're going to be able to answer.
I think what I like about it is that it reflects more than just the procedure itself, but the post-operative care that's given in a hospital. So it's nursing care, it's all the post-surgical care, anesthesia, all of those things.
I just wanted to make a comment in response to Tom's question. Large purchasers are looking at things like this. There is a large company that looks at whether what you've done with LeapFrog, and they set up their payment for you. So if you're at a hospital that they approve of, you get 90% reimbursement. If it's not, it's 80% reimbursement. There's been talk about tiering hospitals, and so putting them into three different tiers and then shifting it over. So there's all of this stuff going on, coming out of value-based purchasing that is looking at all of this. So, yes, this is very important.
So I think we're ready to vote on the usability criteria. So those who feel it fully meets the usability, completely meets the usability criteria. All right, those who feel it partially meets the usability criteria.
Ken?
And those who feel it minimally meets the usability criteria. And that moving on to feasibility. So that is how easy it is to collect the report on issues of concerns about exclusions and accuracy and implementation issues. Seems like it's pretty straightforward in that it comes from administrative databases. That's where you validated it. It's not honest, but it's not a narrow data set that's not FIS or something really can be used on any standard set of discharge data. So it seems pretty straightforward. Tom?
Well, do you have any idea, I mean, how much of a database person time does it take to collect and sort of analyze and report the data? Is this a 1.0 FTE for a full year or 0.2 or, you know?
Well, I mean, assuming the data is coming from an electronic database or an administrative data set, it doesn't take very long at all. So it's not based on primary data collection.
So you could probably somehow program it once,
yes,
and then
yes,
it becomes automatic.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And we have a program and documentation to do all that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, so I think we could vote on the issue of feasibility, those who feel it completely meets the criteria for feasibility.
Y'all there? I think it's everybody. Is there anybody? Okay, that's what I got.
All right, and then we move on to voting overall for the measure. And again, I think because this measure has not been in general use, this would be time-limited endorsement, presumably with requests for specific testing about applicability and usability. I think looking at the potential for narrowing the confidence interval by extending the date over periods of time. So those in favor of the time-limited endorsement of the measure, what's your question?
I got everybody.
That's good. Okay. We're done.
That one.
Thank you very much. All right, I think we will do one more measure before our break.
All right, 10:30 break time rules.
Okay, our next measure is measure 29. This is the standardized adverse event for children and adults undergoing cardiac catheterization for congenital heart disease, which is the ratio of observed to expected clinically important preventable and possibly preventable adverse events risk adjusted. So do we have...
Hi, my name is Lisa Bergerson again, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to be at the table today. And from a smaller community, a physician who performed cardiac catheterization procedures, on both children and adults from congenital heart disease. Over the past 15 years, cardiac catheterization has evolved from diagnostic studies to primarily interventional studies with not an insignificant amount of morbidity associated with those procedures. So the field has become very important for us to understand the outcomes for these children that can potentially have bad outcomes in the catheterization lab. We look at a lot of different measures, overall event rates, I chose this outcome to share with you because it has some face validity and it's important to us as a community as a measure to track. That being clinically important events, those events that are life-threatening or potentially life-threatening to the child, and with a potential opportunity for improvement in care for those that are either possibly preventable or preventable. And as a community, we think that this is an important measure and outcome for the children.
Terrific. So why don't I ask members of the work group to comment, and specifically, again, initially on the area of importance.
Well, I think she's adequately addressed the importance of this, and that this is becoming a very strong interventional type of a specialty as opposed to diagnostic as it was historically, and this brings on whole new implications. Basically, now they're doing a lot of cardiac surgery with a little tiny tube. And so I think looking at adverse events and the things that can go wrong with that, which are not inconsequential, is extremely important as this specialty evolves.
Any other questions from either work group members or the members of the committee about the importance of this?
I just want to follow up on one of the committee's comments about why we're including adults as part of the measure. Can you give us some numbers? Because I'm assuming you're defining the adults are probably young adults
as opposed to, I don't see a lot of 65-year-olds, maybe.
Exactly,
that's my point.
So the measure was developed to capture our entire population. Depending on the physician, their case mix can have varied amounts of adults. So it was developed to capture the entire case mix for institutions performing these procedures. We could limit this outcome measure to children less than 21 years of age without losing validity.
So it's so for example, an adult with an anomalous, I'm not going to show my clinical ignorance, but you know, anomalous coronary artery or something like that, which is presumably a congenital problem, you're not talking about that.
Right. So among our six physicians who primarily do neonates, the percentage of adults that we do range from 0 to 15%. It's a small percentage.
My concern in raising that question was, are there a significant proportion of adults who are going through revision surgeries, second or third surgeries for their congenital heart disease as opposed to their first surgery? Because I assume if you're 25 years old, somebody's picked up on this at this point.
Right. So, But
you still might be catheterized. You might be catheterized, presumably, in your preoperative revision.
So some of the adults that we catheterize will be And again, this depends on the case mix of the particular interventional. It may include lay presentation, ASD, lay presentation, PDA, pulmonary hypertension, or redo operations, conduit revisions requiring hemodynamics preoperatively. But like I said, we could limit this measure to less than 21 years of age.
Yeah, I just thought maybe somebody going through catheterization as an adult probably had a different morbidity or risk.
Having spent a decade practicing at the Brigham and taking care of a lot of these adult cardiac surgeries, I mean, adult surgeries, we literally have 30 and 4-year-olds who had tetralogy procedures decades, you know, who still go to children's for catheters that they know have better than anybody else does. So it is, the question would be, are they really the same group or should you really segregate?
Have you looked at?
We haven't looked at these outcomes, the risk adjustment method for this outcome was developed using with the adult population in it. We haven't excluded them and gone through the same steps to look at how the model performs. But I would expect that it would perform at least equally as well.
We also didn't find age to be a statistically significant predictor of adverse events in our model.
Okay.
Your specification for numerator specifies a pediatric cardiac catheterization lab. The majority of hospitals that are not children's hospitals use one cardiac catheterization lab for both children and adults. And using your definition, you would confine it to only specialized pediatric cardiac catheterization labs, which excludes a significant number of cardiac caths. And then when you start including stent placements in adults, you haven't really specified congenital heart disease. So I think I understand what your intent is, but your wording can lead to the measure being applied differently than you intended.
That's a good point. I think to be more precise, it would be procedures done for congenital or acquired heart disease, congenital heart disease in the adult and child. So if you were doing... let's say that you were in an institution that was not a pediatric institution, but you were doing procedures for congenital heart disease, you could apply this measure. Does that answer your question or address it?
Yeah, it does. I would just ask that if we approve this, that the conditions be a change in the wording.
Do you have, again, prevalence is not an absolute requirement, but do you have any sense of the number of procedures done in a year that this would apply to?
Yeah. We estimate that there's about 100 institutions across the country that do regular cath procedures on both adults and children with congenital heart disease. And the volume there... our institution probably performs more than most at about 1,200 a year, and then the other institutions about between 300 and 600.
Some a little less. So
let's see.
So if you get about 500 per institution, you got a. Yeah, okay. And you have about 1,000. So, 500, you said how many institutions? 100.
About
100,
yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if we could change the numerator to catheterization cases performed by a pediatric interventional cardiologist instead of in a pediatric cardiac cath lab. Because I know our institution, we have an interventional cardiologist, but he is, as Al describes, he does his in a general cardiac cath lab, but there is a specialized room
where he does it, but it's still considered an adult cardiac cath lab.
That would be clear. That would be clear specifying it by the physician.
I actually disagree with the wording. I would just say that cardiac cath procedure is done on congenital heart disease, because what worries me is adult cardiologists who are doing procedures on adults with congenital heart disease. And I think that quality measures may hopefully put an end to that.
Okay, so on our first criteria of importance, this is a threshold criteria, so it would be either yes or no. Question is, how many believe this meets the threshold criteria for importance? Show of hands. Okay. So now we can move on to the, which we've already been delving into, but we can move on to the issues of the scientific acceptability of the measure. So why don't we delve more deeply into that? Can you talk a little bit more about how adverse events are defined, how reliable the adverse events, preventable adverse events, how reliable the identification of those are? You have some data in the report, but if you could talk more about that.
Well, in 2003-2004, reviewing the previous literature on cardiac catheterization and how people were reporting outcomes, most institutions would report them as minor or major. And we felt that didn't lend itself to, could have greater clarity by separating them out into five categories. And so we started collecting adverse events at our institution using these five categories of severity, one being an event that happened, but there was really no clinical consequence, and two being a minor event, three being something that was potentially life-threatening, like a supraventricular tachycardia that you had to cardiovert, four being something that was clearly life-threatening. You had to do CPR on a patient because of an arrhythmia, and five being death. So we started collecting our adverse events using these definitions. Our hospital later adopted them in other areas across the entire hospital. As a field, recently, we have got together as a group and started to talk about nomenclature and how we're going to define both the procedures that we do and complications, because the nomenclature just didn't exist previously. So in the next year, our definitions for severity will be adopted by the International Pediatric Cardiac Code and will be available to the community to use. So we'll be publishing a complications list that has qualifiers for severity and definitions as we have been collecting events over the past 6 years. Currently, there are eight other institutions who are collecting data in a similar fashion and coding their events using our severity classifications. And I referred to them in the background material. This is the Congenital Cardiac Catheterization Outcomes Project, and this group of institutions started collecting data in 2007, and we now have a data set using uniform definitions since 2007, and it includes now 13,000 cases.
So as I hear these, I guess the reason I was asking about it, but I think you started answering beautifully. So we know that voluntary reporting of adverse events in hospitals is miserable, to put it bluntly. I mean, and we know that when people do audits using something like a trigger tool, they vastly increase by, you know, factors of 5 or 10 the number of adverse events that are identified. But this seems different. This, you've got specific events that are defined and typically recorded in a procedure anyway, and you're capturing them more routinely. So again, it's different than routine hospital collection of adverse event data, and more valid and reliable.
When we audited the data set that was in the paper that I for the measure development. For level 3, 4, and 5 events at our institution, we captured all of them. In this group of institutions that have been collecting data over 3 years, they do pretty good with the 3, 4s, and 5s. As you imagine, the 1s and 2s, there's some variation in what people would consider important enough to report. But among the 4s and 5s, they at least in a 10% audit, they reported all of them. And among the 3, 4s, and 5s, it was as high as 92%. So there were a few level 3 events, which were primarily respiratory events even before the procedure had started related to anesthesia. So because they're clinically important, they're
can be captured. Well, I have a real problem with allowing so-called non-preventable events to be excluded because I think that, first of all, what might be preventable by one person is non-preventable by another, and second of all, maybe it's just because surgeons enjoy wearing hair shirts, but traditionally when you're doing surgery, the patient dies within 30 days of the operation, even being run over by a bus, that's an operative mortality. And so I really have a problem with excluding these sort of vague, what is an example of an unpreventable event?
Yeah, let me explain to you why we did exclude it and why it is important that we exclude preventable events when looking at this outcome. Non-preventable. And it actually goes towards the other comment, which was of the moderate events as defined. How do you know that they're not based on the patient's condition rather than how the procedure was performed? So what we're trying to do here is exclude those events that are because of the patient's condition that you could not have avoided. So, for example, you get called in the middle of the night to catheterize a patient who's having ventricular tachycardia, and there's a suspected anatomic problem, and they're trying to manage them medically, and you bring them down to the catheterization lab, and they go into ventricular tachycardia, and you have to do CPR on that patient. There was no way, as an operator, you could have avoided that event. Whereas I bring a patient to the catheterization lab for an elective aortic valvotomy. I cross the aortic valve, and I jam a catheter down in the LV, and then patient goes into ventricular tachycardia. In that case, maybe there was something I could possibly done to avoid that event. And I want to make sure that I capture that.
Right. And I'm not talking about events that occur and result in maybe a patient's death just on the way to the cath lab before you do a procedure.
No, I'm talking about if I bring a patient to the cath lab and they have ventricular tachycardia and I put catheters in them and I'm doing a diagnostic catheterization and they go into their fatal arrhythmia and I can't get them out of it, and it was a pre-existing condition where there was nothing I could have done in the cath lab to avoid it, then those are the events that were...
That's like saying if a patient dies when you're opening the chest, it doesn't count. And that just isn't right.
Well, it depends on what outcome what the outcome of interest is, I think.
You know, I mean, I guess I look at it this way, from a broader perspective, and I said this earlier, if you exclude things that are not preventable from the collection of the data, they're never going to be preventable because you won't identify them, okay? And what you can do, and I think it's very reasonable in some cases to do this, we do it at the STS database, congenital database in several instances, is you collect the data and you exclude them from the analysis, which means you exclude them from
both the numerator and the denominator.
So you would have the data, but the measure then would still not reflect those data.
Right, you could decide to exclude those from the analysis of the data. And then at some point you might want to say, change your mind. And put them back in for some various reasons, some advance or...
Yeah, so we're not proposing that people not collect data on not preventable events, and we feel actually quite strongly that any event, and we're quite concerned, should be reported in your database and looked at. But for this particular metric, we wanted to focus on... events where there was a possibility for improvement in of care. And so the problem with putting preventable events in it is if you're going to look at different institutions, it wasn't the outcome that we were interested in.
Can you remind me how you are determining preventability? Is it on the code, or is it the judgment of the person who's entering the data?
Yeah. So we at our institution we collect this data and at a monthly meeting or more often we review all of the events and as a group. Come to consensus on both the severity and the preventability. And there are fairly precise definitions. I think one thing that we would need to do if this metric went forward is look at within our data set and the C3PO data set, what were those events that were not preventable so that we can have clear definitions for the community of what we would consider, like I did with the VTAC example.
So, love the name. With your C3PO data, did the other sites... great. Did the other sites do assessments of preventability, and did you assess comparability of the preventability assessments across multiple institutions?
You know, it's really interesting. When we started this project, many people said, and it was part of one of the comments about, I think, feasibility, oh, you're not going to get the community to tell you about their bad outcomes. But in fact, the project was met with a lot of enthusiasm, and we actually had to limit the number of sites that could participate. And they, like I mentioned in the audit, they report both their minor as well as their high severity events. Two cardiologists review all of the events, and more often than, well, and they have reported, similar to our earlier data, about a 30% rate of not preventable. So they have not been liberal with the definition and rarely misapply it. So we rarely change it when we review their preliminary classification.
So
I just have one final comment about the issue of excluding non-preventable cases, and there's probably nothing to do about it now, but going forward, I think when we began this discussion about the overall importance, this is a ballooning area. and the example you described says to me really that you're doing more and more non-surgical corrective procedures on an increasing risk population is what it is. And that doesn't mean to me necessarily that when they carry higher risk, it's non-preventable. It may mean that more sensitivity in the procedure has to be addressed for their risk to be lower because they're carrying higher risk. So I just throw that out there.
There is variation in rates of these events among even our practitioners at one institution, and this variation has to do with different populations of patients being catheterized by different interventionalists. When we sat down to look at procedures, we were able to identify 84 different types of procedures that we do with varying frequency from 1% of our cases maybe 20% of our cases. So similar to what Dr. Lilla had explained, we couldn't adjust just based on one procedure type. So what we did is we put all of those different procedure types into different procedure type risk groups so then we could adjust for the case mix complexity of a particular operator, and then this would apply to an institutional outcome. You could apply this risk adjustment model to an institution's outcome. We haven't compared adverse event rates among institutions in cardiac catheterization because for many years they said, well, my case mix complexity is more complicated than yours. But what we've shown by developing these models and looking at this measure is that you can do it fairly. You can do it fairly, and we should be looking at these outcomes.
Yeah, I too am very concerned about putting some things in the non-preventable category. I think 10 years ago many people would have said that a central line infection was non-preventable. And we know that, in fact, they are preventable. And I just worry that when you do that, then it sort of becomes an accepted complication. And, oh, well, we put a central line in, they get infected. Oh, well, we do this particular cardiac catheterization procedure, and something happens, but it's not preventable. And that worries me because I think you stop thinking about, yes, well, maybe it is preventable if we did something else.
So maybe to delve a little further into this, could you walk through, because I'm a little fuzzy on this, just kind of the algorithm for what actually happens, so in terms of the data collection and the categorization of adverse events and then adverse events as preventable or not. So I just don't understand the process right now by it's going through and who's making which decision and judgment and how it's being based. So if you just walk that process through, I think it would help the committee.
I'm going to say one background thing. I just want to say that, as Lisa mentioned, we've imposed these categories at the entire institution of the Children's Hospital of Boston for all of our adverse event reporting. And one of the things that the discussion is very important, and I don't want to minimize it. I just want to make this point. One of the things that is the most difficult barrier to overcome for clinicians to feel good about measurement is being felt, feel like they're being unfairly measured against something that happened on the day they were there, that there is absolutely nothing they could have done to prevent it, like the VTAC example. And it's been comforting and helped with our adoption of this concept to include a way out for that. How exactly to measure it or where the slippery slopes are is a real issue, and I don't want to minimize that. One of the things that we have done at Children's is if someone says something is that we ask them to articulate what they could have done differently to prevent it. Okay, and because if there's absolutely nothing that anybody can think of that they could have possibly done differently to prevent it, it's different. Okay, so I don't know if that helps, but this is a field that's getting their hands around some of those issues around infection and the rest of it. So I just want to state that point, that in order to have clinicians adopt these measures, they do have to believe that it's fair.
I agree fully, actually. I think it's totally on target. I think the challenge comes in when you're sort of doing this high-stakes, potentially high-stakes measurement, wanting to be sure that different institutions are using similar criteria. So that's why, really, just the I think, at least for me, I'm not completely clear on the process that actually takes place. So just walk that through for me, how you're proposing that it be take place in with the measure that you are proposing be used.
Well,
can I choose
under?
Sure.
I think I've articulated that this is evolving, and that institutions, all institutions that perform these procedures, are collecting adverse events. They're doing it in one way or another. So, to make the measure work, they would need to collect their adverse events and record them using the definitions that are available through the International Pediatric Cardiac Code, which will be published this year. They will have the severity as a qualifier for an event. They will have clear definitions attached to them, and institutions would have to adopt those definitions into their collection of their adverse events to be able to apply the measure to their institution. There is a national registry that's starting for congenital cardiac cath through the ACC called IMPACT that could potentially be a way to centralize data collection if they adopted the same strategy.
So again, the event happens, the institution records it, the institution categorizes it reliably using the 1 to 5 scale. And again, the process, I'm really just a process question. Then after that happens, or before that happens, when does that preventability assessment take place, and who is making that judgment? That's really a process question.
Well, I think there's two ways that I'd like to answer. One, within C3PO, the registry of these eight institutions, when the event happens, they assign preliminary categories, and then those are independently reviewed by two physicians. Now, that's a research project. So that's how that registry works. But what the individual institutions would need to do is do what they're already doing, record their adverse event, and assign the severity category or preventability category at the time of the event. And all institutions also review events as a group, I think, in some format, whether that be weekly or monthly or bi-monthly, I think it's pretty common in most institutions to review their adverse outcomes. So then they would have the opportunity in that venue to come to consensus and make sure that there's agreement and no operator bias in the classification.
Well, I just want to clarify that non-preventable adverse events are all collected. There's not an option to not report because, you know, obviously voluntary adverse event reporting is a problem, and if you give a provider a loophole, it's going to take it. And that's the thing that I'm most concerned about. But, you know, whether or not you determine after careful analysis that this event should not be included when we analyze the data and present and report results, that's a totally different matter, and I fully understand that. But you have to identify these adverse events or nothing's ever going to be done about them.
I think in terms of this metric and the usability by institutions, I'd like to just echo what Kathy said in terms of physician buy-in and feeling that they're fairly evaluated. Also, I think we underestimate physicians' willingness to be transparent, especially when it comes to the opportunity to improve their care. So if you had, if you collected your events and you had the opportunity to apply this model to your outcome and calculate your standard adverse event ratio, and you looked in the literature and you saw that hospital X's rate was this, then and you were outside of the bar for performance, you might try to do a little bit better, and that's the purpose of putting this forward and sharing it with the community.
I think we've had a great discussion. I'd like to move one more question about scientific acceptability because I don't want to be.
I think what Charlie is trying to say is that as long as there is a standard criteria for what is considered preventable that's applied across the board uniformly to all institutions, then that would go a long way to make us feel a bit more comfortable. But what we would be uncomfortable about is that Institution A says, well, that was unpreventable, and Institution B said, yes, it was preventable, then you're not comparing equally.
So why don't we vote on the scientific acceptability criterion? So how many vote that it completely meets the criteria for scientific acceptability? Okay. How many would vote that it partially meets the criteria for scientific acceptability?
I get 8.
And feel that it minimally meets the criteria?
Just wanted to check. Did Marlene Miller join us at all?
Okay. Okay. Did we get everyone then?
Yeah.
Okay, good. And then on the usability, because I think we've discussed the usability a fair amount in the context of discussing scientific. So this relates to the issue of whether it's understandable, harmonization, and there's another element to it, which is whether it provides data value. How many feel it completely meets the criteria for usability? Feel that it partially meets the criteria for usability? Okay. How many feel it minimally meets the criteria for usability? we got everyone. And then for feasibility, so again, data being a byproduct of care available through electronic mechanisms, exclusions of protein specified, not susceptible to an accuracy and ease of implementation. So how many feel it completely meets criteria for feasibility? Partially meets criteria for feasibility? Minimally? And then I think an overall vote, and again, this one, again, I think would be, the vote would be for time-limited endorsement subject to...
With the conditions of the wording changes.
Conditions for wording changes around setting and provider and even age, potentially age restriction to under age to be determined. David, questions?
I'd like to see some testing of non-preventable adverse events.
I think, again, the question there is that something where we would want conditional approval for testing or more recommendations?
More time.
Suggested
over
to the
time.
Developer that they sort of do further evaluation and testing and come back at a future date.
And could we add to that to the objective to standardize the definition?
Yes, I agree. No, but I think that the measure ought to be introduced and used, but I think a lot of attention ought to be paid to this non-preventable event issue, and that should be monitored and reported back at a specific time in the future.
I can repeat what you said, but Helen?
No, I do. We were just talking a little bit about the, there's enough changes that you guys are recommending that the question is, do you actually want to see some analyses back before you make this decision? I mean, I don't know how much you could look at these analyses. I think, you know, one of my only concerns with looking at this is at least the way it's written in the submission form, the definitions of how anybody beyond your institutions would use this measure would be very difficult. This is intended to be a measure at a national, that any hospital could pick up and use. And at least what's in the submission form is really fairly imprecise. And you may just have more of it that we haven't seen. But I think given the number of conditions, I just sort of wonder whether you actually want to take just a quick look back.
What I've presented to you was based on a single institution. As I mentioned, we now have 3 years of multi-center data that we could answer your questions with.
And one of my concerns is, again, my suspicion is that the institutions you test this in are all very high-performing, highly competitive academic institutions, and that if we were to apply this broadly to the many places that are doing cardiac catheterizations, they may not all share the values and, you know, quite well. I mean, we can't assume some of the transparent orientation of some of those institutions, so that's partly why I have questions about standardization and consistency that would not be as dependent on the goodwill of the participating institutions, to put it bluntly. And so that's why I'm not sure some of those questions would be fully addressed within the context of the collaborative among the, I just want to say C3PO again, so I have a term. So, I don't know, maybe what would be, my sense is there's a lot of interest and excitement about this measure and the desirability for further testing of it before we're on record endorsing it even in a time-limited manner. But, you know, we don't want to give the perception of kind of going back to ground zero and come back at some indefinite future date. So,
sounds like the testing may have already been done, and we could just table it and then consider it at a phone conference call or something.
that may be the best thing to do.
So rather than vote, suggesting that we table this, and they can provide additional information on first clarifying the definitions, looking at how this would be effective if you limited the age criteria, for example, and coming back with some of that information.
And Charlie, I think there are several suggestions about actually
and the word
specifications for the numerator and denominator.
Yep.
That should be in here too. I'd kind of like to see the actual text of what we're voting.
Was there a comment on the phone? Did someone on the phone say anything?
No, this is Elliot Main. I'm waiting for the next measure.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
Sure.
We're a little behind schedule, I'm afraid.
And just one more announcement, since it was brought up, since you have the data, does any ability to look at the number of events that weren't classified as potentially preventable, just to kind of give a sum of how many are actually being excluded, might be useful given the number of comments.
I would be happy to provide additional analysis. It would be helpful for me if all of the comments and suggestions could be summarized.
Let me have one. Yeah.
It would be great. Thank you very much.
So I think, rather than calling the vote, why don't you recommend that and leave it with kind of a call. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is great. So what I'd like to do is call for a 15-minute 10 well, I'll say 10 minutes. It will be 15 minutes. The 10 minutes break. And we will try to
reconvene
at 11:10.
Okay.
With Elliot.
Yeah.
With Elliot. So, Elliot,
you can
great. Thank you.
We usually don't worry about it. Pants downstairs, but you usually shouldn't have any problems.
Just go out there and stick
your hand
out.
Yeah, I'll be there. I'll kind of one waiting for you.
Okay. Yeah, well, the only other thing would be if you had two people go on the same cab if they're going on almost the same flight time.
Right,
Sometimes that can be a little
muddy. It's true. Yeah, no, we can do that. I don't know how much time people are thinking they're going to leave.
Yeah, a lot of meetings like this, people sort of
trickle out.
Sort of pass around a sheet of paper.
Right.
That way you can say, oh, okay, here's two people. Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
There was a big they don't know what to do.
And they thought, oh my God, The names are, but for example, all the mess you put in the gut and stuff, okay, so, there were gel phones. Cheaper used gel phones.
I don't think
so. $10,000, and there may be a few cases of getting people together. But there's too many applicants in the And, you know, and so bringing that into it is also one of the purposes of saying, we can do the phone money, we can do the money. But it has made a difference. And I
have the whole state.
Yeah. And he, I mean, that man, like, the and what he just told me, heard me, because he got a family and he tried to work. And then, so what happens, once they put their money in the surgical,
I guess maybe I talked to him about it.
I think that's what
I think that the questions we're asking are not necessarily exactly targeting the response that we want to receive, and so the application does reflect
that.
It's really a difficult thing to do, to have a good application, but when it's ambiguous, it's really
hard.
I mean, two of these measures, if we didn't have a deeper there today, I would have rejected our view.
And nobody can agree. I mean, I think three frauds says that they're one. 12 for transportation. Nobody knows what blood show, but you don't know what number. But I'm sorry, 34%. And once you get it, you can rely on it.
Carolyn,
I'm sorry, you shouldn't be asking people to do this at 20, you know, at 18, right? Or something.
Yes, but it wasn't.
I got looking at
variation.
More for government to use than even though these aren't very special.
I thought it was good. I like
Our next measure we're going to be reviewing is number 31. This is the healthy term newborn, is the title of this measure. This is the percent of term singleton live births, excluding those with diagnoses originating in the fetal period who do not have significant complications during birth or the nursery care. I just want to also mention to the group, one of the attachments I sent out last night was a visual diagram of this measure, which may help as we discuss it. And Elliot, just so you know, I also have it here, projecting it so the group can view it. Did you, Elliot, did you want to take a few minutes just to make a few comments about the measure or introduce it in any way, or we can just open up for discussion?
I'd like to say a few comments. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak from San Francisco. It's a long trip back to D.C. I'm going to take you back to the beginnings of pediatric care, and instead of looking at complications of operations or procedures, this is really a reflection of both maternity, the summation, if you would, of maternity care and NICU care, or nurse, regular nursery care. A normal newborn is the most important outcome for us as obstetricians. I'm a perinatologist and lead the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative, which is the sister organization for the Perinatal Collaborative led by Jeff Gould. It actually serves as a balancing measure for most of the other measures that we have in the perinatal realm. Ideally, you would like a institution that has an average or even a below average cesarean section rate and a good healthy newborn outcome rate, as opposed to a hospital that, say, has a very high C-section rate and also a high rate of abnormal health, a low rate of healthy term newborns. So you really don't want to be in a position of pushing in one direction and having adverse outcomes in the other. This is applicable to all hospitals that do maternity care. We've been working on it for over 10 years, tweaking the codes, looking at ways of capturing data in settings where people don't choose to code diagnoses for medical legal reasons. For example, a number of hospitals in California have given up coding for perinatal asphyxia because that's a marker for plaintiff's attorneys. What we've learned over that decade, though, is that they do code for procedures because you get paid for procedures. And so being on the ventilator, being having CT scans, et cetera, all get coded quite accurately. And so this measure is a mix of diagnosis codes, procedure codes, and what we've had more recently as a fail-safe is a length of stay indicator. To start it off, though, instead of doing extensive risk adjusting, we did exclusions from the denominator. And the denominator is chosen to reflect healthy babies as the mother arrives to the hospital for maternity care. So we have excluded congenital anomalies, intrauterine growth retardation, babies who have hemolytic disease due to RH, for example, or high drops, or infants of mothers who have drug addiction, for example. So that's our starting point, and that actually accounts for over 3 million babies in the United States. So this is a very high-volume measure, which is important because bad outcomes in babies are still an uncommon event. So the incidence that we're looking at here is somewhere between 1 and 3% is the range we've seen in hospitals, which makes it still a reasonable number given the very large denominator. The only other measurement in this domain that's been approved and out there is a ARC measure, PS17, for birth injury, birth trauma, and a version of that was previously picked by NQF to be a measure. Unfortunately, that measure has significant limitations. It's very low incidence, about 2 to 3 per 1,000 births. It is highly dependent on coding. A article came out this last month looking at the HCUP experience with that measure nationwide and found that 75% of all the cases of birth that meet this criteria for birth injury, birth trauma are identified with two IC9 codes that both begin with other. Other specified birth injuries and other non-specified birth injuries, which are very variable diagnoses. That's probably the reason that measure was not picked up by the Joint Commission or LeapFrog in their core measure set. So this is really trying to fill a void of a neonatal measure that would go into the basket of measures to support maternity care, and maternity care that includes nursery care. I'd be glad to take any questions or be available. Thank you.
So first, if I can ask members of the work group if they have questions, and then so any questions, David?
I just like to comment that I felt that this was the best worked out and most complete and probably easiest to evaluate measure that I reviewed, and I really didn't have anything wrong with it.
Just a question, Elliot. Could you comment on its use in other environments? I understand it's being used internationally, the UK and other countries.
Not this. There is a normal birth measure in the UK, but that actually is a maternity measure rather than a newborn measure. A normal birth there is one without any interventions at all. Everyone has been looking for this kind of a measure for a long period of time. It's basically the holy grail of what we're trying to do. And it's taken a while to put together the different pieces of the different codes to do this. One of the challenges is that past measures have tried to include codes from the mother as well as codes from the baby, and that is very hard to do on any kind of large scale because those two charts don't intersect, don't link to each other in most data systems. We had to take some extra time to focus only on the codes that we could get from the newborn's chart. There are flavors or variations of this that have been tried elsewhere. There's not one in the United States that's gotten this far.
So, again, if you were explaining this in words, this is I mean, I know you could do it either on the healthy side or on the non-healthy side, but basically you're saying this is term infant who doesn't have, so I'm just trying to think how you're explaining this to a consumer, because...
No, this is, well, we wanted to frame it specifically so it would be understandable by the public. So it's the proportion of term singleton lifers without a diagnosis, without a complication prior to birth, who do not have significant complications during the birth or nursery care. Versus, you have a good take-home baby.
Well, I know that, but I maybe am the only one on the committee who's having just a little trouble understanding the committee, but I'm still unclear, because, again, if you're coming to the hospital, actually, you don't know whether you have a congenital anomaly or not. So,
so in this day and age, you often do with the advent of ultrasound, but it's excluding diagnoses originating in the fetal period is the other way of explaining it.
Okay, so you're coming to the hospital. Presumably, you think you've had an ultrasound or something like that, so you know if there's going to be a major congenital anomaly, and then you're saying, and you know you've made it all the way to full term, then you're saying, what's the likelihood that everything's going to go okay in the hospital and you'll come home with a healthy baby?
Correct.
Excluding bilirubin issues and excluding a few other.
Yeah, there's a few minor things like bilirubin, but things that are clearly... well, we also have excluded, if we go into details, social situations such as foster care, babies being put up for foster care that may have a long length of stay in the hospital, babies that have drug withdrawal, conditions that originated before you enter the labor and birth process would be the ones that be excluded. The conditions that arise during or after the birth process are the ones that are included.
All right. Any other questions specifically on the importance, and then we can move to the other.
I was just curious about the variation that has been observed in the measure.
We field tested it in a large health system in Northern California that has 25 maternity hospitals. We've seen variations there of the full measure of almost 150 to 200%. In other words, it's a fair amount of variation. We have more limited detail on subsets of the measure that we published in the past that show actually quite large variation looking at the state of California, and when it's, again, subsets have been used elsewhere, there's probably three to four-fold variation.
Right. Just wanted a quick question. I'm not clear how you would deal with low birth weight babies.
Those are not included in this measure. So this is, well, there's, this is 37 weeks or beyond, because those obviously have a large number of complications. So we're looking, and, you know, the mother's expectations are quite different if you're coming in with in preterm labor or premature. And we also do exclude term low birth weight babies, which, as I mentioned before, those are small for dates or intrauterine growth retardation, because that, again, is a condition that arises before the labor and delivery process. So that's a specific exclusion.
But you have here that have not been, these are morbidities that may or may not be clearly related to medical care. I was just thinking about all of the conditions that might impact whether a woman has a healthy baby or not, such as nutrition, diet, where she lives, what kind of support she has. There are just tons of data that support that even, especially, let's say, with African-American women, that healthy middle-class African-American women deliver more low-birth weight babies and have higher mortality morbidities than their Caucasian counterparts. So I'm not clear how these measures will help us to get at disparities among different groups who have had poor outcomes for a very long time. And I was just commenting, well, Dr. Zimmer just commented, that if you're poor, then what happens if you need a sonogram, for example? What happens if you can't afford your calcium in your milk or whatever? I like what you've written, but it seems like to me there are so many other issues that revolve around what you're trying to do here, and I don't see any discussion about it or any acknowledgement of it. So would you just help me with my confusion?
Of course. It is very well known that African-American populations and other disadvantaged populations have higher rates of preterm birth and small for dates babies. That would be covered by other measures that address our nationwide and racially associated rates of low birth weight. This is really focused on you know, once a mother gets to term, what are the complications that arise during the labor and birth process rather than focusing on the prenatal care, which is really a subject of a different type of measure. So this is, you know, whether or not you have an ultrasound. If you end up with a birth defect, you would be excluded from this measure. So this is really trying to set up as many apples to apples type of comparison that has been looked at actually small rural hospitals to urban hospitals and big and small, that would compare really what happens in labor and delivery as to the outcomes then in the nursery. So this looks, for example, at as the numerator then is full of the codes for birth, includes the birth trauma, birth injuries, including the ones that actually were excluded from the ARC measures, such as brachial plexus injuries and clavicle fracture, the diagnosis and procedure codes around hypoxia and asphyxia and respiratory complications. We have seen a rise in newborn respiratory complications from the use of elective repeat C-sections at 37 and 38 weeks. This is the measure that would identify those as the partner quality improvement arm. That's one, for example. The other partner quality improvement arm is the IHI safety bundles around oxytocin use. Where this would be the neonatal measure that would go with that to identify babies that had perinatal hypoxia or asphyxia related to prolonged oxytocin use. In terms of disparities per se, though, if it does not address the low birth weight issues or any really of the prenatal issues that occur in those types of populations, but it is focused on how you manage labor and delivery, which should be the same for everyone.
Elliot, this is Marina Weiss. I may just be reading this wrong, but as I understood the measure, it was the absence of conditions or procedures reflecting morbidity. But you're going to the other side and identifying the morbidities or the procedural problems that may occur. Is that right?
It's how you choose to frame it. It's either you get the absence by identifying the presence and subtracting it. It's a nice way of framing it, I think, for families. And that's why we chose to do it that way, which is to focus on a healthy baby outcome rather than an ill baby outcome. But the two are mirrors of each other.
And the use, the utility of this measure stated in a positive from your perspective?
suppose you're able to say that your institution, 97.2% of the children are born healthy and everything's fine, given the exclusions and so on. What have we learned?
Well, it is in comparison to other centers. And the goal in this should be as close to 100% as you can get. So, you know, we have worked with some focus groups on whether it should be framed positively or negatively. People are attracted to the positive nature of it. When you get down to the exact numbers of how it's presented, it you know, is 98 different than 97.5%. It gets a little tricky, and as with a number of the measures, when they're publicly released, they end up with stars based on their quintile of distribution and the statistics that have been applied to them, and that's probably how it would be displayed in a public release mode.
So what
better than expected or worse than expected or average.
So would it be fair to say, then, that what you're doing here is attempting to think in terms of presentation to the general public, but at the same time you are capturing information that will be relevant to clinicians who are providing care, in that you are, in fact, keeping tabs on the morbidities. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. We wanted to have something that would be both a numerical value and perhaps for clinicians we might flip it and say, you know, what is the incidence of ill-term infant outcomes, which would be then around 30 per thousand on average, as opposed to the ARC scale, which, as I said earlier, about 3 per thousand, and that allows you a lot more play in an ability to statistically compare hospitals to hospitals and accounts for and allows you to look at smaller hospitals as well as bigger hospitals.
And if you could indulge me just one more minute here, and then I'll be quiet and let others interact with you. You said in your opening description that the purpose of this measure was to be a neonatal measure to support maternity care. Could you explain to me a little bit more, maybe I'm just not getting it here,
sure.
That link? I mean, also, a healthy newborn is the ultimate positive outcome.